Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you. We could not do it without you. We say that every week, and we should say it even more often. Wonderful job that you do getting connected and giving us research information and on and on. And ladies and gentlemen, I will say today, this is today. This is Friday morning. It's not Thursday evening at 9 p.m. My gosh, I'm trying to confuse you, aren't I? No. But we will not today mention O.J. Simpson or Donald Trump. Let's see, have you been watching any television news? I mean, now I place bets on how long it takes to hear Donald Trump's name. Do you think these news reporters could actually get up off their seat and go out in the street, in the mountains and wherever, and study news and talk about it? But these major networks, they have, and yet, you know, one person reporting the news, they got five or four sitting there in a panel all hollering and screaming, and they consider it a success when four of them are all talking at the same time. They laugh and giggle, and oh my gosh, I can't believe it. And then they switch off to what a Nutrisystem said. Okay, welcome to Blog Talk Radio. And this is the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And I am your host, Keith Haley. And tonight we're going to, this morning, we're going to deal with something that's a little bit unusual. And this requires a little insight and creative thought about what's going to happen. We're going to have a man talk about his book. It's Garry Kasparov, a world chess champion as both a child and adult. His book is called Deep Thinking, Where Machine Intelligence Ends and Human Creativity Begins. We are on the brink, and in some limited number of categories we've already crossed over, where artificial intelligence, for example, is teaming up with these robots, and people that are in this business are beginning to fear this, that soon the robot will be outthinking us and could cause severe damage to the United States, to the world, and to citizens all over these countries. Now, we need to listen to this and see if we can pull anything out that we can build boundaries for this artificial intelligence business and thinking for us, as opposed to us thinking. So, my gosh, you might even have to put down your cell phone if this goes far enough. And then you add this to drones, And police departments all over the United States are starting to see drones more and more. But you're going to have drones with robots, and they're going to be thinking. And we do have drones that find lost people and that type of business. But based on what happened here about a year ago, the government, these drones are going to be flying all over the place. You've probably seen it. And anyway, it's an interesting time, and we hope you'll pay attention to some of this stuff, because you and I as citizens need to be informed about the future of this artificial intelligence, machine intelligence business. And, you know, I don't want a robot that thinks for me or thinks beyond me. That's even more frightening. So, okay, that's it on that kind of stuff. Let's go ahead and take a look at a few of the news things going on today. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. I won't be able to do it all, but let's start with this thing here. This is an article in the paper in my town, and it talks about opioid addictions. And can you believe this? Drug overdose deaths now are leading the cause of deaths in Americans 50 years old or younger. According to the records, 5 residents have died from overdoses in 2015, 10 in 2016, and 6 so far this year. And this is in Seneca County, Ohio, up northwest, kind of semi-rural area. And what's going on with this? He says they need to get above water to focus on this next generation. People 10 to 19 are becoming addicted to opioids. They start with prescribed pain after medical or oral medication after oral surgery. Dentists, by the way, are not limited in what pain medication is prescribed. Can you believe that? So dentists are issuing all this stuff out, and then they get you involved in that. And then when you can't get any more, if the dentist stops giving you some, then you know you got your local opioid illegal criminal agent probably down the street who will provide this for you. But this is just incredible. The people that are, I don't understand the mentality of taking something. And you hear these people, one guy in Clark County, Ohio, we talked about on a radio show. What did he do? He called the cops 3 times in a day. They let him go home, and then he calls in 24 hours 3 times. I think that was the detail. But anyway, it's unbelievable that this thing is just going on, and they need to do something about it. And I don't know how many people can take this stuff and not act sensibly in terms of the danger that it can cause. Oxycontin, a commonly prescribed pain medication, is similar to heroin chemically. And this gets people addicted, and then they go to whatever all that other stuff is. So anyway, interesting. Here's one about Texas prison system. A federal judge has ordered the state of Texas to air condition a prison in southeast Texas where the temperature routinely rises over 100 degrees in cell blocks. It's a decision which could easily spread to other prisons. And he said it was unruly, it was making people sick, and the elderly inmates are at risk. Ellison cited statistics, that's a judge, Keith Ellison, that 22 inmates have died from heat stroke and other heat-related conditions in Texas prisons since 1998, and they should do something about it. But what about fans? No, they're probably doing that already. But if you lived in Texas, you kind of get used to this heat, and you got some stupid people like me who actually go out and rode the Hotter Than Hell 100 in Wichita Falls, Texas. That's where the temperature's over 100 degrees, and you ride 100 miles, and about half the people finish the thing. So really stupid. Okay, we got a jailbreak. Here's another new. 2 men in Fremont, Ohio, just up the road from Tiffin, Ohio, where I live. 2 of these men, Mickey Hardy and Jordan Chapman, they escaped from jail. So if you happen to see them around, if you live in this community, They have white T-shirts on and orange pants. The police department advised people not to approach them and to call immediately. U.S. Marshals, by the way, are offering a $1,000 reward for each man to anyone who can assist with their apprehension. And ladies and gentlemen, there are lots of federal agencies and lots of police agencies at all levels. But the United States Marshals, which you hear very little about, are absolutely one of the best. They believe in hiring bright people, maintaining standards, and these boys and women work all over the place, and they work hard. They don't sit in their desk 6 weeks at a time waiting to go outside and do something. You know what I mean? Okay, guess what they're going to do? For heroin dealers, they're going to – the cell phone number is the lifeline of the business. For customers and cash, they can top $10,000 in a single day. So dealers and their associates intent on preserving their specific phone numbers often have contingency plans in place to transfer well-known numbers to a phone as a way to avoid law enforcement. So what the cops are going to be doing now, this is in Wisconsin, they got a new tactic. They call it a seize and freeze. It seeks to disrupt this practice, allowing authorities to freeze such numbers and render them useless. That sounds like a pretty good idea to me, right? Law enforcement sources told Fox News the strategy is an additional tool in fighting the deadly trade in Milwaukee. Heroin is hugely profitable and could prove useful nationwide. So it'll be interesting to see. There's more details about this, but Milwaukee police are going to get involved in this, and let's hope something like that works. And these heroin dealers, when we catch them, why don't we never, ever let them out of prison again? Why don't we do that? They can't sell heroin if they're in prison, right? But they'll go in, and they're nice guys and women. And then they'll be out in a year, 2.5 years, 3 years, and who knows how many people's lives they've already ruined. Okay, here's an interesting one. The wonderful police department of Dallas, Texas, and it is. Remember, they had 5 officers killed in a downtown ambush here this past year. They have a new police chief, her name, is Yusha Renee Hall. She's a 19-year veteran of the police force in Detroit. In Dallas, that has very talented people. They required college degrees back in the last century or 2 centuries ago, perhaps. But everybody had college degrees in Dallas, and they wonderful people. I've known lots of them. Written books with book with one. They have selected a new police chief, and she has her father was killed, a police officer in Detroit. She's a proven leader, according to the Dallas city manager, with a stellar background and a passion for public service. Now, she did say something a little odd. What kind of do it a little different, a little better? We kind of do it a little different, a little better. She's talking about women. She's bringing a women's touch to the Dallas Police Department. Dallas Police Department has lots of women police officers. And if we add that special something to law enforcement, that truly, truly calms the savage beast. Well, I don't think that's entirely fair when we have many officers that are as kind as you can be, and we now know and have known for about a decade or more that the number one motivation to be a cop was to serve people. Not to arrest people, not to shoot, not to fight, tackle them down, get involved in automobile chases. They want to help people. And if you ever get in a police car and ride with cops for 2 or 3 days, you'll find out most of the calls they get are service. Even in the most crime-stricken cities in the nation, only 1/3 of their calls have anything to do with crimes. And that's a nationwide statistic that's held up. But anyway, he says female police officers are put under the microscope more than their male counterparts. Unfortunately, we're still in that realm. I don't know if you should say things like that when you're just coming to the police department. Then she says this. You can do whatever you put your mind to. She said in a video, you always have to be twice as smart as your counterparts. And I guess the counterparts she's talking about are probably males. I don't know. I don't like that as an incoming chief. She may be an absolute star and has a record of that, but I don't think you start with that. Did you hear about the five-year-old that took his two-year-old brother? Two young brothers in Putnam County, West Virginia, were never taught how to drive. That's good. But the boys, age 5 and 2, played their share of driving video games. So they were watching their mom drive, and they knew that she kept an extra set of keys under the floor mat of her Ford Focus. Oh, my gosh. So when the brothers wanted to visit animals on their grandfather's farm, which is 7 miles away, they hatched a plan to trek over on their own. While their mom thought they were playing in the front yard, the sons were actually taking a joyride down the road. So the five-year-old boy, get in, come on, we're taking off. He takes off with his two-year-old brother, and they actually drive, and they make it 3 miles from home, and they weren't lost on some random street. The brothers knew exactly where their grandfather's house was. We're almost halfway to their destination before the trip came to an abrupt end, the sheriff said. The boys navigated the twist in the road, an intersection, a right turn before turning off the roadway and into an embankment. But Kevin's, they weren't killed. But can you imagine a five-year-old boy jumping up in the driver's seat? He probably has to stand, doesn't he? Well, how's he touch the gas? Maybe the two-year-old touched the gas, but that is really something. I'm going to be quick on this one because it's a lot of detail. But concealed handgun permits in the United States have soared by 1.83 million since last July, setting a record for the fourth consecutive year. That brings the total number of handgun permits in the country to 16.3 million. I would have thought it would be more than that, with some of the biggest increases among women and African Americans. And this article has a lots of details on it, but it's a pitch, and people want to be safe. And you got to remember, about 300,000 people a year use a handgun to ward off a felon, or firearm to ward off a felon, and 97% of the time they don't shoot. The felon gets the idea. And this information is presented by John Lott, and John Lott is an authority on handguns, that's for sure. NRA and all kinds of people, but Lott has all kinds of detail on that. He's in the Crime Prevention Research Center now. And to get a chance, the states with the most permits by adults is Washington, 10.2, West Virginia, 10.1, Arkansas, 9.6, Oklahoma, 9.5, Florida, 9.4, Kentucky, 9.1, and Colorado, Connecticut, North Dakota, 9.9 and 8%. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to get a handgun permit because they're afraid to carry them. They're afraid what the police will do. They're afraid that they're going to get shot accidentally. I've talked to people that have that fear. Then you've got some other states, I think, where you don't need one permit. What, Texas, if you're traveling more than 25 miles or something like that, you can carry a gun in the car. But it's kind of interesting what's going on. Let me see if I got one more here for you on news. That's enough for news today. Well, the police are seizing your phone records. Prosecutors first pushed for the power to seize telephone and internet records themselves, bypassing the need for a judge. They argued the power was necessary to help them quickly track down missing children and sexual predators. But records obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union shows that prosecutors have used that significant subpoena power hundreds of times in routine investigations relative to larceny, fraud, assault, and other crimes. This is big news. And if we don't restrict police from just taking things whenever they want, private information, I think we need to do something about that. And we have, but the cops have been avoiding it. And, you know, I'm a big cop supporter beyond belief, but we need to do something about this. Okay, we got, let's do a blonde joke for the day. Okay, I went to the bank the other day, and I I asked the teller to check my balance. You know what she did? She pushed me over and down onto the floor to check my balance. Can you believe that? And of course she was blonde, the teller. Okay. All right, here's some green tips, man. There's lots of those. How about this one? Drive less, walk, ride your bike, take public transport or a carpool. Approximately 50% of car use is for trips within 3 miles, 5 kilometers of home. Resolve to not drive when the 5K radius or where you're going is within that radius. You'll be saving fuel and reducing pollution. How about this one? Another thing for your car. Do not idle your car for more than 10 seconds unless it's 40 below, in which case, let's just hope it starts. Idling it for longer than 10 seconds uses more fuel than restarting your vehicle. Lastly, avoid aggressive driving. Yeah, I'd like to stop that. Jackrabbit starts and hard braking can increase fuel consumption by as much as 40%. You notice these people when they're coming up to stop signs, like onto a highway, and then they're in a crossroad, they drive up as fast as they can. To the fact, I had to stop one here a couple of days ago, so I thought that guy in a pickup truck was going to blast through the stop sign. And he waves at me when I, you know, kind of reacted. But, you know, we can save a lot of energy and fuel and power if we just drive peacefully. That could be a nationwide motto, right? Right, Audrey? Let's drive peacefully. Okay, that's enough for the news tonight. I think what we're going to do now is go ahead and start out with this story about artificial intelligence, and this gentleman that's doing it, Garry Kasparov, he speaks about his book, Deep Thinking. He is a genius. I don't know if his IQ is even measurable, but give me time to get this set up and we'll listen to it. I might move around this one a little bit because they talk about some other things, but I think you'll enjoy hearing this guy.
First up, here's Garry Kasparov on the potential of artificial intelligence. Hello. Pardon me while I get the microphone all set up. Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Holly Kernan, Vice President of News at KQED in San Francisco, and I'll be your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Garry Kasparov. Garry is chairman of the Human Rights Foundation, former world chess champion, and author of the new book, Deep Thinking, Where Machine Intelligence Ends and Human Creativity Begins. Born in Baku, Azerbaijan, in the Soviet Union, Mr. Kasparov became the under-18 chess champion of the USSR at age 12. And the world under-20 champion at age 17. He gained international fame at the age of 22 as the youngest world chess champion in history. He defended his title 5 times, including a legendary series of matches against his arch rival, Anatoly Karpov. Mr. Kasparov was one of the first prominent Soviets to call for democratic and market reforms. He was an early supporter of Boris Yeltsin's push to break up the Soviet Union. In 1990, he and his family escaped ethnic violence in his native Baku as the USSR collapsed. In 2005, in his 20th year as the world's top-rated player, Mr. Kasparov retired from professional chess to join the vanguard of the Russian pro-democracy movement. In 2012, he was named chairman of the New York-based Human Rights Foundation, succeeding Václav Havel. And he was facing imminent arrest in 2013 during Vladimir Putin's crackdown, and he moved from Moscow to New York City. His U.S.-based Kasparov Chess Foundation nonprofit continues to promote the teaching of chess in the education systems around the world. Pertinent to today's discussion, Mr. Kasparov is a senior visiting fellow at the Oxford Martin School with a focus on human-machine collaboration. And I actually had to cut stuff out. He's so accomplished. He's also a member of the Executive Advisory Board of the Foundation for Responsible Robotics. As you know, 20 years ago in May of 1997, the world watched as Mr. Garry Kasparov, the greatest chess player in the world, was defeated for the first time by the IBM supercomputer Deep Blue. He likes to point out that people forget that just a year before he won his match against computer. And he says that the...
I think I'm going to move up a little bit. She keeps going on and on and on. He's impressive, that's for sure.
Now, the reason I mentioned that is that because that somehow answers this question that I'm being asked all the time. So Vladimir Putin is so popular. A lot of Russian stories are connected to... it's quite funny that 8 months ago, I was here in San Francisco and just traveled across the country promoting my previous book, Winter is Coming.
Which we'll talk about also.
Yes, by Vladimir Putin and the enemies of the free world market stopped. Everybody wanted to ask me about IBM and Deep Blue. So now I have a new book, and I think it is capable. But somehow it's probably these two subjects are connected because a lot of Russian stories are connected to cybersecurity, to, it's not AI, but... it's about interference using new technology. Now, regarding the situation in Russia, it's also quite an extraordinary moment. I just arrived here today in the San Francisco airport, and while waiting for our car, so I looked at the news from Moscow from Alexei Navalny, so calling for a big rallies on June the 12th.
Huh.
So it seems that in 4 days' time, we'll have another massive rallies in Russia. There are, I think he said something, at 211 cities now, just the people in these 211 Russian cities, they already expressed their desire to join these rallies against corruption, but of course it's against Vladimir Putin. Now, the reason I mentioned that is that because that somehow answers this question that I'm being asked all the time. Vladimir Putin is so popular. How do you know? You know, here in this country, you can measure the popularity of a politician by looking at opinion polls. Maybe it's, you know, it could fluctuate plus one, plus minus three, four percentage points. But it cannot be, you cannot mix 80% and 30%. Now, in Putin's Russia, first of all, you have to recognize that people who are being asked anonymously, what do you think of Vladimir Putin, they tell you that even if 80-90% of people are not willing to take action, the actual level of support for Putin, enthusiastic support, it would not play by its own rules. And Putin wanted to eliminate any opposition. And looking at the list of people who marched with me 10 years ago, just five, six years ago, used and became, you know, it's a crusader. Bashing Putin and Russian interference, and I could...
okay, one more rest of questions. Masha Gessen, who's a journalist, whether he's in attending a summit, piloting a plane, or hang gliding with Siberian cranes, it is the spectacle of power.
this is not a deadly virus.
Right.
This is not a deadly virus. So, and also, Putin and Trump, let's look at... Yeah. Then, a few months later, how could we let these brave people fighting alone? He knows, not because he read books, attack a strong dictator. As long as dictator looks strong, there will be no uprising.
Well, let me get to the point about lies. You tweeted, I think yesterday, the point of modern propaganda isn't only to misinform or push an agenda, it's to exhaust your critical thinking and to...
And it worked again. And, of course, he decided that he could use it globally, having with troll factories and also many lobbyists, and finding, he was quite successful, because, again, he's a KGB dictator, finding his weak spots in the free world, because you can lie in 100 different ways. And now with all these social media channels, you can manipulate public opinion. Propaganda was limited because they had a story to sell. They had to convince you that, you know, Soviet army was on the seventh floor. He said bluntly, it's Russia is the most dangerous nation on earth, considering the United States' interest, because of its intentions and resources. It just comes and goes. We can spend a lot of time talking about conspiracy theories and how many potential KGB infiltrators there, because you look at the Saddam officers that work with Russia. Then you have many field commanders from North Caucasus that mysteriously, you know, came to Syria. You get to see a proper response from the United States and Europe, just making sure, not so much for Putin, but for his cronies that...
Here. And you're an optimist, which is wonderful. I love that about the book, that you really think that if we combine machine power with human-powered thinking, that's going to be good for the future. Can you just talk to us a little bit about how you frame your thinking around machine learning and AI, artificial intelligence?
So the idea behind the book was to combine, you know, a few things. One is, it was my personal story. It's being part of this human-machine competition and what I learned from that. Another one was the story, it's a history of human-machine relations. And I thought it would be important to write it in just plain language, explaining that it's a natural progress. And you have to demystify that because there's so much panic based on this dystopian vision from Hollywood, the Terminator, the Matrix. You know, let's slow down, you know, just make sure that, you know, we look at the problem objectively. And, of course, looking in the future and promoting what I believe is the future scenario, human plus machine collaboration. And that was the outcome of my matches with Deep Blue, when I just realized you can't beat them, join them. But what is it? I think it's that you mentioned again the elections and politics. It's always bothers me, this kind of hypocrisy, because machines for centuries, if not for millennia, have been taking over all forms of manual labor. Now, when machines will take over jobs from, you name it, manufacturing jobs, that's natural. Now, the only difference is machines coming after people with college degrees, political influence, and Twitter accounts. And that's suddenly, it's a big story. But again, in a history timeline, it's just a leap forward. And we just have to realize that many, I would say, more menial aspects of cognition will be taken over by the machines. Now, of course, it's fear. Oh, what's going to do? There's still so much room for us to apply our creativity when machine intelligence and human creativity begins. That's the subtitle of the book. Because what I learned, and I could try to put it in just in kind of formula. Anything that we do, and we know how we do this, machines will do better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the emphasis is on we know how we do. There's so much
that you can program.
That codify. Something that you can codify and send to the machine. Now, there's so much we are doing without knowing how we do that. It's and it's not just simply emotional things. It's a lot of decisions we made that based on like a parallel tracks. It's a multi-layer decision. And machines always know the odds. But they will not be able to make decisions because they will have to compare incompatible things. Recently I just thought about just had a speech in Amsterdam about 10 days ago for a bunch of AI experts, and I wanted to come up with something that's just like a vivid example. And I thought, you all remember The Empire Strikes Back, the moment when Han Solo was bringing his spaceship into the asteroid field trying to escape from the imperial fleet. And C-3PO tells him in panic that the chances of surviving the asteroid field 3,720 to 1. And the response: never tell me the odds. Now, it's a very important moment, because the machine was right. The chances of surviving were slim to none. But machine couldn't realize that the chances of not getting there were even less, because you will be caught and then killed, or even worse. So many things that's for machines, knowing the odds and making precise calculation of the chance of success, machines will never give you the right advice, and that means we still have room to cooperate, collaborate, and make those efficient decisions. And it goes even beyond these extreme situations. So then, many cases, for instance, it's you are in the store and you want to buy something, and it's off your budget. It's too expensive. Now, machines definitely show that it's recommend against it. But now the problem is the birthday party, and you have to give a big, you have to buy a gift. And you can start adding these little things. And as you realize that it will be impossible for machine to combine them and to come up with decision that will be satisfaction to you. I'm just having a dream that like 20, 25 years ago, hope I'll be around to see it. I'm sure our kids, grandchildren will be sitting here saying, oh, these stupid people, they were driving cars. Look at this. You know, the greatest cause of death. Now we don't go drive those cars. What will happen? By the way, no matter what we think about it, it's going to happen.
It is happening.
It is happening, and we just have to make sure that we know what we're going to do. And it's not about saving jobs. These jobs cannot be saved. I believe that the problem is not jobs being lost too fast. I think it's too slow, because
wow.
It slows down the cycle. Because what happens always, at the end of the cycle, you have a new cycle. Because before any technology creates jobs, it kills jobs. So if you slow down this part of the cycle, you will prevent it starting the new cycle of economic growth and possibly, you know, creating new sustainable jobs. Now, we have to take care about people, because a lot of people, they have great difficulty, especially my age or older, we have great difficulty of adjusting. So you just have to find out how to generate enough income and enough opportunities to make sure these people will find their spot, because, again, it's going to happen. And trying to slow down just makes it more painful.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest today is Russian human rights activist and former world chess champion Garry Kasparov. I'm Holly Kernan, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio. You can catch up with the club on Facebook and Twitter, and you can see program videos on the club's YouTube channel. All right, let's go to a question from our audience, which is, how did you get interested in playing chess? It was your mom, right?
Unfortunately, nobody was there to tweet this moment. It is. That's why I cannot tell you exactly when it happened. It was probably winter evening, late 68 or 69, in Baku, watching my parents trying to solve chess puzzle. Just think, I'm sure in this audience, I look at the age. Many people remember there were the newspapers with a little section at the bottom of the last page with chess puzzles, and I was captivated by the game. So I didn't know how to move the pieces, but I was in awe immediately with the game, and so I was lucky. So I found it. I learned how to, by just watching them moving the pieces, I learned how these pieces, learned the basic rules, and that was the moment.
That was the moment.
That's the legend says so.
When you were talking about your match with Deep Blue, the second one, the one that you lost, you said humans crack under pressure, machines don't. And then at the end of your book, you say humans can dream, machines cannot.
So what is the contradiction? One comment. It's about human machine competition, and it's why it's useless now just to fight machines in any games. And we could see now that it's the same happening in the goal. And it's every game will be eventually cracked. Or to be more precise, machine will crunch it by winning. Because it's not about solving a game of chess. The number of wiggle moves in the game of chess is 10 power 45, which they say is more than the number of atoms in the solar system. Let's agree it's unlimited. But machine doesn't have to calculate everything and to make a first move announcing mate in 20,555 moves. It's about winning the game. So winning the game means that you make less mistakes than your opponent. And humans cannot play the same steady game. So we always make mistakes or even inaccuracies, and that's enough for machine to capitalize. So that's why this pressure is too much for humans to bear. And now we could see the same in Go. But again, it doesn't tell you that we are dealing with form of AI, because Deep Blue was as intelligent as your alarm clock. Yeah, though, of course, losing to $10 alarm clock didn't make it feel any better. No, seriously, it was a successful project, the parallel processors. Deep Blue's speed was phenomenal in 97, still amazing today, 200 million positions per second. But when you look at the way this machine made decisions, it could offer you very little, if any, dreamt of input into the mysteries of human intelligence. Machine didn't need intelligence to play this game of chess. Chess was vulnerable to the brute force once hardware got fast enough and algorithm got smart enough. Today we have computers, by the way, that are just far more sophisticated and stronger than Deep Blue, and I always surprise people saying that a free chess app on your mobile phone is stronger than Deep Blue. Just trust it.
So here's another audience question. What's your perseverance technique after you lose a game?
Look, I didn't lose many.
So I didn't need to develop a technique.
It's a good question. So first of all, I believe that every game, whether I won or lost, was an important piece of information I had to learn from. In one of my earlier books, How to Imitate Chess, I spoke about the gravity of past success. That we know that we have to learn from our mistakes and from our losses, but we believe that if we won, it's because we were great. So I knew that every game, even if I won, contained certain mistakes and certain inaccuracies. I have to learn about it and make sure next day I will be armed with some new ideas, because my opponents who lost, they will find mistakes and they'll come back with new ideas as well. So losing the game, which was quite painful, I confess in the book I was a
sore loser.
Yes, sore loser. But you cannot stay on top for 20 years if you're not a sore loser, because you have to take it very personal. First of all, it's you. It's you made a mistake. You have to find it. You have to kick yourself in the head. But it's just coming back next day. It's just another game. It's the same story as the game you won, because it brings you very valuable information. So it's more painful. But at the end of the day, it's about your ability to learn from these lessons. And again, I was angry, but I always thought that now I have a chance to come back being stronger. Because what I learned from my mother, just from my childhood, is game of chess was not just about winning or losing. Of course, it was about winning. But the most important thing, it was my chance to make the difference. That's why, by the way, I succeeded in just moving away from chess and doing other things, because it's about making the difference. And I know that if I can make the difference, I'm on the right path.
There's a quote in your book that I love, which is, hard work is talent.
Absolutely. It's just I'm not happy when I hear all the time, oh, this person is talented, this one is less talented, but he's a hard worker. That's part of the talent. Working hard is a part of the talent, and it's a very important part of the talent.
I love that. Okay, so here's a question from the audience. I'm mostly using the ones who are doing big print, because I left my glasses back stage, so I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time reading some of them. How do you see AI, or do you, taking part to eliminate human bias and discrimination?
Okay, You know, it's a big mistake considering this device as that's something that is good by definition.
He's holding up his smartphone.
That's Android. So it's neither good nor bad. It's agnostic. You can do many great things with this. You can connect with friends. You can do business, transactions. Unfortunately, you can build a terrorist network with that as well. Mm-hmm. So it's the same with AI. It's not going to change our lives. Because if it's the hands of Putin or ISIS, it will not work for positive things, but it will serve the destruction. So that's why I think it's a big mistake trying to sort of shift our responsibility to AI, to machines.
Mm.
It's in our hands. So we just have to make sure that these tools will serve us, our interests, our community, our country, the world, the mankind, because there are always people that will try to use the same technology to destroy. It's every technology, it's like coins with two sides. So with nuclear technology, you can have a nuclear power station, but you can have a nuclear bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same as here. So that's why I warn you not to expect paradise because we just reach a new level of technological development.
Well, and that's where you say we have to combine human intelligence and compassion and quality with machines.
Exactly. The human factor is indispensable, absolutely indispensable. And it's not just, you know, humans having passion and understanding and machines cannot match it, but it's about purpose. Machines have the best algorithms, and eventually we could have something phenomenal, you know, the best algorithm in the universe, but machines will never have purpose. And one of the reasons, because we do have purpose, but we don't know what it is. We'll never share the secret with the machines.
All right, here's another question from our audience. Aside from the Turing test, how will we know when real AI has arrived? Explain the Turing test.
Yeah, but if you cannot, that was the original idea of the founding father of computer science, Alan Turing, thinking that in the moment that you will not be able to tell the machine from a human by asking questions, that's artificial intelligence.
Mm.
Ironically, Turing and also other founding fathers of the computer science, like Claude Shannon, they believed that chess could be an ultimate test. They were, by the way, wrong because, as I said, you know, it's the Deep Blue won the match, and now we have these many very small computers, chess engines, that playing great chess, by far stronger than Deep Blue, but you cannot call them intelligent. I don't know that there will be this watershed moment. So this is the moment when we believe machine is intelligent. It's not just one day in the calendar. This is not a day in history. I think it's happening. But if we talk about intelligence, we probably have to leave the Department of Science and move into the philosophy. Because first question is, what is intelligence? What is consciousness? And when we are looking for machine intelligence, are we looking for the result or the process? How are we going to tell it? By machine solving the problem and coming up with a result that is intelligent, or we have to make sure that it happens the way that we can understand it, so that we could see it is a similar path of getting from A to B as if we done it on our own. My opinion, I'm not an expert, just more amateur, I think it's more about the result. Because when you look at the latest incarnations of early AI, like DeepMind, Google's DeepMind, AlphaGo, unlike Deep Blue or any other chess engine, where if you have a couple hundred years to spare and look at the million miles of logs, you'll find out the origin of the decision. With AlphaGo, it's more of a deep learning, and I don't think even Denis Kasabis, the man behind the program and his team, they will ever tell you why version 6 played better than version 9. Because it's literally black box. So this, which is, again, it's good and bad. It's good because it's deep learning, it's sort of self-improving, but if it gets bugged, you'll never find out what it is. So, it's a new challenge. I wouldn't be too fearful about it because it's a part of the process. We just have to get adjusted to it.
Why do you think chess is such a powerful and enduring metaphor for human intelligence?
I would probably add in the Western world, because if you look at Japan or China, they're old versions of chess. In Japan, the most popular game is not Go, but Shogi. It's the Japanese version of chess. And the chess being played around the world, we don't know exactly how it happened that the game moved in different directions over centuries and absorbed social cultural traditions of certain countries. That's why the Oriental versions of chess are very different from ours. But everywhere, it being judged as an ultimate test for intelligence. I think the fact is that the game survived for so long, and even today, at a time with computers, it's still being treated with this great respect. Just for instance, in the Japanese shogi champions, Mejus, this is a history for almost 400 years, and it's just the list of people that are just considered to be the smartest in the nation.
Do you still enjoy playing chess?
Oh, I still love the game. I'm watching this. I follow this. I play some exhibitions, and as you mentioned, Kasparov Chess Foundation is very active in this country and around the world, and I'm an active part of this process. It's not only working with blueprints and schools, but promoting the game as the important educational tool, which I think it's another big discussion about education and what chess can do for that and the role of AI in this. But also we have programs for rising stars, and I can proudly say that after 10 years of our work with young Americans, talented kids, this country has the strongest junior team in the world. Next month in St. Louis, Missouri, there will be a match between U.S. juniors and the rest of the world. So that's the... chess will always stay in my life. I would say now it's 25 to 30% of my activities are somehow connected to the game of chess, and I'm very happy with it.
Here's another audience question: as the population ages and many have less mental ability, can AI come to the rescue? I love this question. I hope the answer is yes.
The answer is yes, but you have to find a way. It's a new technology, and naturally, it's not just kill jobs, but it will create certain opportunities. And I think the opportunities they are unlimited, and it's just we have to find a way to apply it. We have been doing so many things that we abandoned because it was too risky, like space exploration, deep ocean exploration, and many other things here on our planet that we could revisit. Because we have such a powerful, if we have such a powerful alliance with intelligent machines.
You mentioned Go. Somebody wants to know if you play Go, and can you talk about the differences and similarities between Go and chess?
No, I don't play Go. I know the rules, so that's why you have to be very, very cautious in taking my advice about the game of Go comparing to chess. What I understand, and we're looking at the game that it was played between AlphaGo, the deep learning machine from Google, and the two matches with top players, Go players. Go is a very strategic game. It's, you may even say, more complicated than chess because it doesn't have the same tactical resolutions, and the game goes longer. And that means that... even if AlphaGo, and I'm not in a position to judge it, but I feel it's not as powerful as the chess engines. We're talking about absolute numbers. But the human performance in Go is way below the human performance, the average performance of, when it's average performance, average performance of the world champion, of course. in chess. So the mistakes that humans make in Go, because the game is so complicated, they could be far more dramatic. So, for instance, I think that Magnus Carlsen today, the current world champion, having white pieces against machine, I think if he wants to make a draw, I would bet on him saving the game.
Hmm.
Now, in Go, I don't think there's a chance. It seems that nowadays they're doomed because they cannot exercise the same control of the game as the world champion can do in chess.
Here's another question from the audience. Do you think that chess has been trivialized by computers?
Well, the gaming there that he's talking about, that's a good beachhead to discuss artificial intelligence, but we've got other things to worry about, like national defense and crime control, and you're going to see this happening. It's already happening in police departments in terms of, you know, who knows, do we need a dispatcher anymore? We can send robots, and we can send all kinds of things, and police and the military are using some of these things now. So anyway, it's something to think about, and I think he, of course, is a world chess champion, and we got a little too much into that, but his book is probably deeper on the issue of artificial intelligence than he makes in this particular presentation. Well, that's it for this morning, and we'll see you next week, next Thursday probably, and we'll now have Berlin sign us off, as he usually does, singing that beautiful song, "We'll Meet Again."
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing song. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.